Moving right along with the Ten Commandments, we have Mitzvah Lamed Vav, the 36th Mitzvah, Shelo Lignov Nefesh Miyisrael, not to kidnap any Jew. Now, of course, it's always translated Lo Signov as thou shalt not steal, but as we're going to see, it's not so simple. Really, it's referring to kidnapping. So it says, Shelo Lignov Nefesh Miyisrael, one should not kidnap any person of the Jewish people, Shenamar. It's not a good idea to kidnap anyone. It doesn't have to be just not just Jews, but nevertheless, the severe penalty that's given in this mitzvah is only if it happens if you kidnap a Jew. And even then, there are very many qualifications to the act. Shenemar lo signov. It says, thou shalt not steal. Okay, uvaha peirush, meaning the received tradition of interpretation of this verse is, shebegodnev nefashos hakosu medaber. The verse is talking about kidnapping, not monetary stealing, which is discussed in many other places in the Torah. Kidnapping is also discussed. But since monetary issues are dealt with very extensively in other places, and also that here we're talking on the order of adultery and murder, which we just discussed, so it's assumed here that it's not just talking about petty theft, it's talking about kidnapping. So shorish hamitzvah niglahu, we don't need to explain what the reason is. If people go around kidnapping each other, then society ceases to function. You can't function at all as a family, as an individual, if you're constantly being kidnapped from place to place. It's a totally immoral act to do. Dinei hamitzvah, the halachos of the mitzvah, kigon ma she'amru, like they said, ein chiluk bein gadol lekatan uvein ish leish. It doesn't matter how old the person is that you kidnap. Could be a male or a female or a child or an adult. It does not matter in the slightest. The nefesh b'chol makom mashma. Nefesh, since it says gonev nefesh, so it sounds like it could be anyone, us, any soul, any living soul. There's another pasuk that discusses it, so it uses the word nefesh. The din ha'av hagonev b'no o harav es talmido. What happens if a man kidnaps his own son? Or let's say a teacher kidnaps a student. So also those two cases would actually not be subject to the full penalty of kidnapping because it has to be a case where, the sages learn out that it has to be that you take someone away from their normal situation. So a normal situation is for the son to be with the father and for the teacher to be with the student. So if the father kidnaps his own son, so it's not removing him from his natural unit. Again, it's not, shouldn't do that. But for technical reasons, it wouldn't be subject to the full penalty. The yeser prateha, there are other limitations. One being that you have to make use of the person that you steal. So even the slightest usage of the other person that's inappropriate would render you subject to the penalty. Even if the they say that even if you lean on him, you just you want to just support yourself a little bit, you lean ever so slightly on the person that you kidnap, that's considered sufficient usage. Another qualification is that one has to sell them afterwards. So you have to kidnap someone, make use of them, and sell them. So those are the qualifications for being subject to the full penalty, which the chinuch is going to discuss a little bit more later. The Yeser Pratem of Orim Beperek Yud Aleph Misanhedrin. So it's in the 11th parak. By us, it's normally the 10th parak, but it switches off back and forth from different editions of the Talmud, whether it's the 10th or 11th parak. But that's where the laws of kidnapping are discussed. The Surah Noheges Bechol Makom Bizchar Mavinikevo. So it doesn't matter, not limited to Eretz Yisrael. Obviously, you're not allowed to kidnap people in any place on the entire globe. A man is not allowed to kidnap, and a woman is not allowed to kidnap, of course. Not just the subject of the kidnapping, but the perpetrator of the kidnapping. It doesn't matter whether that person is male or female. V'over aleha, if you violate this, v'gonev nefesh chayev chenek. Because it says later in Parashat Mishpatim, mos yumas. So the standard penalty, when the Torah prescribes a death penalty, so the standard form is strangulation. So if you do these things, if you kidnap in the manner that I just discussed, one would be subject to the penalty of strangulation. Ushe macharos onefesh, right? So it says that you have to sell the person. Shekein bo haperush, sheinachiyuv chal alav ela ad sheyimkor. That the full extent of your obligation in this mitzvah is not until you sell the person. Shekostuv acher megala olav. So the other pasuk, right, later in Parshas Mishpatim, in the next parsha, megonev ishu mecharo v'nimtza v'yado mosimas. So it has to be that you took the person away from his... the qualifications are, took the person out of his or her natural setting, out of his or her family unit, and you're not someone who wouldn't be part of that family unit or that social unit, such as a teacher. You have to make use of the person, and you have to sell the person. So a lot of qualifications to be subject to the death penalty. But again, still not allowed to kidnap anyone, even if you just want a ransom and you plan to give it back. That's also not permissible. But you wouldn't be subject to the death penalty unless you kidnapped and made use of and sold. Shekosuv acher megala olav. The other pasuk explains it for you. And that's pretty much the discussion of kidnapping. Mitzvah lamed zayin, the 37th mitzvah, shelo lahoyid b'sheker, not to bear false witness against thy neighbor. Shelo lahoyid edu sheker, not to say a false testimony. Shenemar, as it said, lo sanev re'achayid shaker, v'nichpal b'makom acher. So in the second version of the Ten Commandments, which is found in Sefer Dvarim, and Parshas Vayeschanan, it says a slightly different way of phrasing a false witness. It says instead of eid shaker, eid shav. So shorish mitzvah zo nigla. The reason for this is revealed. It's obvious. Ki hasheker nimas v'nelach le'ein kol maskil. Falsehood is repugnant to any knowledgeable person, to any intelligent person. Gam ki be'edus emes ha'olam omeid. So testimony in itself is very important, and indeed there is another mitzvah that we're going to get to eventually, that if you know testimony for someone and you don't say the testimony, then you actually also violate a mitzvah. If you know testimony either against someone or in favor of someone, if you're a reliable witness and you know the testimony, you have to go to court and say your testimony. So that's very important. Shekol divrei rivos b'nei adam is badlin beidus anoshim. Testimony helps to quell disputes, because if one person claims that someone owes him money and the other says, no, I don't owe you money, and one of them can just settle the dispute by bringing witnesses, saying, yes, I borrowed money, or no, you were with us that day, you couldn't possibly borrow money that day. So then you settle the dispute right then and there. You don't need any further quabbling. So that's the testimony in itself is very important. Just like correct testimony is very important for normal functioning of society, so too false testimony can destroy the entire fabric of society. If you have false witnesses running around and saying, oh, if I could just hire witnesses and say, you owe me $1 million, and I have two witnesses corroborating it, and that happens all the time. Nobody's going to be able to keep tabs on their finances. Nobody's going to be able to run their lives in a proper way. So, of course, false testimony is very the prohibition of false testimony is very rational and easy to understand. Dinei ha-mitzvah, the halacha is as follows, kigon, mimi mekablin edus, umimi ein mekablin. So this isn't in terms of false testimony per se, but these are just that Sefer Chinuch is bringing in now general rules of who can testify and who cannot. Uvamo yipaslu b'nei adam lahoid. How could some person become disqualified to give testimony? And basically, there are two ways you can be disqualified to give testimony on behalf of someone. One is if one is related to that person, a close relative. Sixth cousin would be fine, but a first cousin, or certainly brothers and sisters, or parents and children, or even grandparents and grandchildren, some are asur midaraisa, some are asur only rabbinically, but nevertheless, there are halachos regarding how closely one can be related and still give testimony about that person. Or the same thing with two witnesses. The two witnesses can't be related to each other. But then there should be a system. If there are a lot of false witnesses, then you have to have a system that two witnesses, you wouldn't believe the witnesses. Like even in halacha, there's a situation where two witnesses come and testify according to a certain thing, but something smells fishy to the Beis Din. So the Beis Din is allowed to use their discretion to even disqualify the testimony of what seemed to be two fully kosher witnesses if they intuitively feel that something's fishy, something's not right. So that's one reason that two people would not, or, and two people either because they're related to each other or they're related to the litigants, would not be allowed to offer testimony. But another reason someone wouldn't be allowed to offer testimony is if they commit sins. So if they violate negative commandment, then they are not fit to serve as witnesses. It has to be, if it's something that everybody knows is us, or if you don't, if people, like if you say, if you you once say Lashon Hara, so it doesn't disqualify you to be a testimony, to be a witness, because everybody does that once in a while, and hopefully you did tshuva afterwards, and it's not, people don't even realize that it's really usher. But if you, let's say, you walk into the supermarket, one of our neighborhood Goyish supermarkets, and you buy steak, and somebody sees you walking out with a steak, and they say, what are you going to do? And you say, well, I'm having a barbecue tonight. Everybody knows you. All Orthodox Jews know that it's strictly forbidden to buy meat from a non-kosher butcher. So
I was asked to be an aide at a wedding
one. Yeah.
And the only question that I was asked was, did I gamble for a living?
Oh, that's another thing. Right. Yes. Excellent. That's the third thing. So besides not being in fulfillment, actively and obviously breaking commandments that everybody knows are us, or negative commandments. Now, the thing is, if you show that you're not very makbid on money, so you gamble for a living, you gamble once as a side thing, doesn't disqualify your testimony. If you gamble for a living, or let's say other things, let's say your type of work requires you to be in a certain state of undress. Okay, let's say there's some type of physical labor where you have to take off your shirt to go to work at it. So, and then when you leave your place of work, you don't put on a shirt to go walk in the street. You just walk home. Oh, I don't really care. I'm still in my work clothes or unclothes. You walk like that in the street. So you show, it shows that you're not makbid on your kavod. You're not makbid on your personal honor. So then that would also disqualify you to be a witness. So basically, it's the three categories of being related. Via what we call a rasha, the halacha calls that if you violate a negative commandment that everybody knows is usher, or it could be if somebody tells you, it doesn't have to be specific technically as something that everybody knows is usher, but someone would have to warn you in order to disqualify you to be a witness. Let's say you're about to, the Rambam gives the example of, let's say you're about to tie a knot on Shabbos. Rambam says, not everybody knows, you're not allowed to tie a knot on Shabbos. So if somebody warns you and says, oh, you know, that's really usher, it's not just a minhag, it's a real halacha, you're not allowed it's a d'oraisa to tie a permanent knot on Shabbos. So if he says, oh, thanks for telling me, I'm not going to do it, and he's tied many knots in his life, so that didn't disqualify him from testifying before. But now if he went ahead, after somebody told him it was usher, somebody reliable told him it was usher, and he went ahead and did it anyway, then it would disqualify him even if it was not a generally widely known prohibition. But like I said, like if eating non-kosher meat, everybody knows that that's usher. And the third category is if you show for either you're not makbid on your personal honor, you're not makbid on money. Another example that Chazal give is if you walk around eating in the street. So that's another example of someone who would be disqualified from giving testimony because it shows was chush of people. Apparently, this is what Chazal had in mind. People who had self-worth would only eat if they sat down in the context of their houses. They wouldn't just walk munching on a pizza walking down Amsterdam Avenue. Outdoor cafe is probably, it says ochel bashuk, if you eat in the marketplace. So an outdoor cafe is still a private area, you know, it's set aside for eating, and people eat there. So, again, I don't think big rabbis would eat in outdoor cafes either. But I don't think that if you eat in an outdoor cafe, that would disqualify you from giving testimony. I don't know. You could argue that some of these things are societally dependent. That if even the most chasha people, you know, sip their coffee as they're walking in the street, so maybe I'm not really sure. It's a good question. Also, of course, there is an intrinsic category of being pasul eidos that we're going to discuss a little bit more later, which is the person in general can never give testimony. That's someone who's not Jewish or is not male or is not free. That all those types of people would not be, are considered pasul eidos according to the Torah. By not free, I mean a slave or a katan. And they have to be, basically, you have to be a non-related Jew, male adult Jew in good standing in the community. It's basically what it boils down to. A slave means all slaves owned by Jews are partially Jewish. Eved Kanani means that your slave is not fully Jewish, that you purchase the slave, a non-Jewish slave, and the slave goes to the mikvah and gets circumcised if applicable, and then the slave is obligated in the same number of mitzvos as a woman, basically. Right. So it's still exempt from time-bound positive commandments. They don't have to wear tefillin and tzitzis and all those things, but they're, even though they're originally not Jewish and they didn't convert to Judaism to become a full-fledged Jew, is right. They are still—they're partially Jewish, but not completely Jewish. The Chetzad Kabbalah Seido. So basically, what happens is the Beis Din investigates each witness separately and tries to ask a lot of questions to try to throw the witness off to make sure that they're really telling the truth. And there's a higher level of requirement of drishas v'chakiras, as we're going to get into in a second, of investigating the witnesses for capital cases than it is for monetary cases. V'chiyesh b'nei adam she'ein me'idin l'chol adam me'rov ma'alasan, and there are certain people who do not offer testimony, not because they're so lowly, but because they're too high. So, for example, the king cannot give testimony because he doesn't feel that he's under the authority of the Beis Din. He feels that he's in charge, so he could do whatever he wants. So his testimony is not necessarily accepted. Also, if the Beis Din or the litigants are not in very high standing in the community, and the only person who knows testimony is the chief rabbi, doesn't have to subject himself to the Beis Din. He's not considered being worthy of his honor for this huge rabbi to go to testify in a court that's run by more ignorant people. Udrisha Sa'idos Vachakira, and all the questions that they have to ask the witnesses, Vachilukin Shabain Eidos Mamun Eidos Nefashos, which I'll explain more in a second, Vachiluk Shabain Drisha Libdika. There are two different types of interrogating the witnesses. One is called Drishas Vachakiras, and one is called Bedikas, or examinations. One is called investigations, and one is called examinations. So basically what the investigations are is when the Beis Din asks about the actual thing that the witnesses are supposed to be testifying about. So in the investigations, the Beis Din are going to say, let's say somebody's accused of killing someone else, they're going to say, okay, what day was it? What time of day was it? What weapon did the person use to kill the other person? And those things, if either of the witnesses says, I don't know, so the testimony is rejected. However, there's another thing called bedikas, the examinations as opposed to the investigations. And the examinations are extraneous things that are not directly tied into the case, just to make sure that the witnesses know what was going on and that they're telling the truth. So, for example, in this hypothetical case of the murder case, so if the Beis Din asks, okay, well, what was the murderer wearing? What was the person who got killed wearing? Well, you know, what color were their shoes? Something like that. So the way that works is that if the witnesses contradict each other, then the testimony is rejected. But if one witness says, I don't know, and the other witness gives an answer, or even if they both say, I don't know, I wasn't paying attention to that, then the testimony is still accepted. But if they contradict each other, so you get suspicious that they're just making it up and they didn't concoct their story to include all those details, and the testimony is rejected. So in certain cases, that's as regards capital cases, but in monetary cases, in certain cases that don't affect the actual thing, the actual loan, say, that they're arguing about, that the case is about, then as long as they don't contradict each other in something very important, then the testimony would still be accepted. That's actually a takonas chachomim, and established by Chazal, because on a deraisa level, all testimony is the same. Technically, that you investigate a capital case the same as a monetary case, and if there's any problem whatsoever in the testimony, then you reject it. However, since it's very difficult to apply such a standard to monetary cases, and if so, it would be impossible for the lender to prove that the borrower lent him money for borrowed money from him, for example, if you really require such a level of testimony and all you have are witnesses. So no one's going to want to lend money to anyone else because they're never going to be able to prove the loan to the satisfaction of the court. They'll never be able to get their money back. So for that reason, the rabbis established that we should be more lenient in investigating the witnesses for a monetary case than for a capital case. And that's part of, again, like, there has to be some flexibility here. That's like, if you go according to strict Torah law, then it's hard for the courts to function normally. That's why the Torah gives authority to the sages to establish court proceedings and to use their intuition to try to make sure the courts run smoothly and society can run smoothly under the jurisdiction of the courts. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, if there's in a Beis Din, if somebody comes and if one of the relatives of one of the Dayanim on the Beis Din is part involved in the case, then yes, it's incumbent upon the Dayan to recuse himself. Absolutely. Ve'achiluk shebein edos b'shtar le'alpeh. The difference between a testimony that's given in a document and a testimony that's oral. So normally in the Torah we like to have oral testimony of the two witnesses, but in certain cases when your document is given that testifies to a loan or something like that, then we have a principle called, technically we have a principle called Edim Achasum Al Ashtar Kemisha Nefkara Eduson Bevezden Dami, that Edim who are witnesses who are signed on a document are considered to be completely telling the truth. And they can't, just like in an oral, if someone gives oral testimony, they can't recant the testimony. So too, if somebody gives testimony by signing a document. But there is an institution also called Kiyum Shtaros, which means that in order to make sure that nobody casts aspersions on the witnesses of the document, so the Beis Din is supposed to, at certain cases, has to sign the document after the witnesses, saying we recognize the handwriting of these witnesses, or so these witnesses came in and testified that it's their handwriting, or other ways of how to determine that these are really the two signatures of the witnesses that they purport to be. In that case, that gives the shtar extra power. But in any case, we don't accept written testimony in general for serious cases like capital cases and things like that. There's a Rube Proteha, lots of halachos about Eidos. It's interesting that this is one specific aspect of Eidos, which is that you're not allowed to give false testimony. And that's not even discussed so much here in the Chinuch. He's giving all the halachos of Eidos. And that you have a whole section of halachos in the Rambam. You have many, many simonim and Shulchan Aruch about the lots of details about what's acceptable in terms of testimony and what's not. Mevorim b'Sanhedrin, so it's discussed in Sanhedrin, and Mumakomos b'Talmud, and in other places in the Talmud. V'nuheges b'chol makom v'chol zman, there are supposed to be Jewish courts in all places and all times, preferably honest Jewish courts that people feel comfortable taking their cases to, which is very, very unfortunately not always the case nowadays, but there is another prohibition that we maybe discuss later against going to secular courts. It's strictly forbidden, according to halacha, when two Jews have a case together to take it to a secular court instead of to a Beis Din. So it's many rabbis lament that it's one of the major failings of American Jewry to establish a system of Jewish courts that command people's respect and make it work. B'zecharim avalo banikevos. This is mitzvah is obviously by definition not applicable to women. She'en anoshim b'toras edus. Women cannot give testimony in Jewish law when a testimony is required, the testimony of two witnesses, but there are certain cases where a woman is believed. There's one is the case of Eid Echad Ne'eman B'Isurin. One is the case that it's not a Eidos, a testimony required in the formal halachic sense of going to a court, but rather when you just need someone to tell you whether such and such a food is kosher or not, then a woman is certainly believed. Otherwise, unless in your house the man does all the cooking, then you wouldn't be able to eat in anyone's house. But of course, women wouldn't work any other way unless women were believed regarding ritual prohibitions. This is learned out, according to some, by the fact that the Torah says about a zava, a woman who has an abnormal discharge of blood, that v'safra la, that she has to count the clean days for herself, safra la. So it says that the husband or whoever doesn't have to be on top of the woman, making sure that she doesn't see discharge for a certain number of days before she can go to the mikvah. So since she's believed about her own status in terms of nida and not nida, then she's believed about other... That's the source for the fact that one person is believed. It could be a man or a woman. That one individual person is believed regarding the ritual status of a certain object in Judaism. A woman is also believed, with the exception of a few relatives, believed to testify that a man has died to allow his wife to remarry.
If you're overseas.
Sha'idus tzarech kivun v'yishuv hadas harbe. In order to give testimony, one has to concentrate intently and be very focused and v'hover alav zeh. And anyone who violates this mitzvah, v'heyir edus sheker b'chavero, and testifies falsely against his friend, sam hakosuv gvul oncho lasos lo kasher choshav lasos l'chavero. So the major prohibition in terms of a testifying falsely is what we call an eid zomim, where it's not just that another set of witnesses comes and contradicts what the original person said, in which case neither of them are punished per se, but the case where a witness says, a set of witnesses testifies, and another set of witnesses comes and says, I don't know if what you're testifying about is true or false. We're not talking about that at all, but you couldn't possibly have been witness to such an object because we were on a trip together that day, the entire day. You couldn't possibly have seen it. So if that second group of witnesses comes and does what we call hazama on the first set, that they couldn't have seen the event that they are testifying about, that's called hazama. And basically you do to the witnesses who are testifying falsely the penalty that the person about whom they were testifying was going to receive. So let's say two witnesses come and testify that a certain person ate pork and the Beis Din was about to administer the penalty of lashes. And then a new set of witnesses comes and says, those witnesses, they couldn't possibly have seen this person eat pork on Tuesday because they were more than a day's journey away from this person with us the entire day. It's impossible. So then the first set of witnesses receives lashes because they tried to get an innocent person to receive lashes, and so they get the lashes themselves. And that same applies to any penalty, anything that they were trying to do to an innocent party, or a party who's now presumed to be innocent based on the testimony of the second set of witnesses. The Yeshua Malkus Kmocha, and in any case there would be, lashes wasn't the best example, because in any case they would receive lashes for violating the Isser. V'sham b'Sanhedrin Gamken Mispar, that's also explained in the tractate of Sanhedrin in the same place. Basically the rules are very similar in terms of who could be a judge as to who could be an aide, but there are more stringent requirements to be a dayan. Basically, I mean, in terms of the composition of the Beis Din, at least one person on the Beis Din needs to know all the halachos that are relevant, and the other two people on the Beis Din could be somewhat less knowledgeable. They could just be able to follow along the arguments. But in terms of intrinsic qualifications for a dayan and an aide, the rules are just about the same.
To continue on this track, so women would be excluded from dayanim, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, and therefore, how do we explain Dvorah?
Dvorah is a very, that's a subject of discussion amongst the commentators. Dvorah seemingly was a judge, so how could she have been a judge? So the two basic sets of answer, the two basic sets of answers was, one, it was a harasha. This, well, we have examples all throughout Tanakh of things that were permitted for in a specific instance because it was an emergency, even though they're outside the normal system of halacha. And the other answer is that she didn't actually judge, she just taught the Dayanim. She was the biggest expert. There's no problem, technically speaking, if a woman, for a woman to paskin or to teach. If a woman knows all of Shas, she's, if somebody asks her, is this chicken kosher, and shows it to her that there's a defect in the chicken, technically she's allowed to paskin if the chicken is kosher or not. So she used to teach people how to rule in certain cases of disputes. That's another thing. That's what the whole system of Yoatzot Halacha is based on. That they train women very thoroughly in the laws of Nida in the same manner that they train rabbis, or probably even more thoroughly in some cases. And that's based on the assumption that a woman is allowed to issue rulings if it doesn't involve any sort of dayonos, if it's just to teach people what the correct halacha is, a knowledgeable woman is permitted to issue halachic rulings. Mitzvah Lamed Ches, the 38th mitzvah, Shelo Lachmod, not to covet. Shelo Lehaalos B'machashav Tenu, La'asos Tachbula Lokachas Lanu, Mashehu Lezulasenu Me'achinu. So not to intentionally bring up the thought to sneakily take something which belongs to someone else. Shenemar, lo sachmod beis reacha. Thou shalt not covet the house of your neighbor or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Uchvar hochichu zichronem levracha mipasuk acher. Dichsiv. The sages already learned out from a different pasuk that it says lo sachmod velo kach talach, that it says you shall not covet and then take for yourself. Sheisur lav de lo sachmod enu nigmar ad shiase bo maisa. That you did not fully violate the prohibition of coveting until you do an action that's a result of your coveting your neighbor's object. Vafilu nosan hadomim, even if you paid for the object, l'chaveru ala chifetz, over gamkin alav de lo sachmod, she'ein lav de lo sachmod niskan b'nesinas hadomim. So even if you paid for it, that doesn't undo your violating of lo sachmod. Kozman shederech hechreach l'kacho mimenu. That it's sort of by twisting the other guy's arm that you took the object from him. Now, this is a little bit interesting because he finishes off that's the true interpretation according to our rabbi. So the problem with that is there's in the Ten Commandments in Parshas Vayeshanan, it says, lo sis aveh, you shouldn't desire. So the Rambam counts them as two different mitzvahs, and the Chinuch, of course, always follows the Rambam. So he's going to tell you in Parshas Vayeshanan that lo sisaveh means not to even desire it. Well, lo sachmod is more of the practical aspect. The Rambam phrases it more like lo sachmod is really doing it in a way that causes that twist the person's arm. And lo sisaveh is the process of thinking over ways that you could get this object. So the Chinuch seems to sort of blend it a little bit here. So I'm not exactly sure what the pshat is with that. But in any case, you're not allowed to covet something in a way that is going to cause you to do anything you can to get this object, even if the person doesn't really want to give it to you. Even if you say, please, I'll give you $1 million. If the person doesn't really want to part with it, but you keep twisting and begging, I'll give you $1 million, I'll give you $1 million. Even if you give the $1 million and the person didn't really want to part with it, but you twisted his arm, that's a violation of coveting. If you go and you like a person, you say, oh, that's a nice house, you knock on the door and you say, I'll give you $1 million for a house, and the person's like, absolutely, I've been waiting to get out of here for $1 million, amazing. That's fine, permissible. Mishurshe mitzvah zo, that's if you just offer to buy something and that leave it at that, and if they say no, they say no, then that's allowed. Mishurshe mitzvah zo, lefi shemachshava ra'a hizo. The reasoning for this mitzvah is that this is a really bad thought. The goremes adam takalos harbe could cause people to get into a lot of problems. Shachar sheyikba b'machshav to lakachas b'menu oso adavar shechamad mitoch oso tava ra. Once you've gotten it into your head that you will not rest until you get this object, lo yashkiach b'shum davar, nothing's going to stop you. Bimlo yirtzech aver lemachro yenos oso b'menu. If you eventually, if the person doesn't agree to give it to you or to sell it to you, you're going to try to find some way to force it out of his possession. If in a really extreme case, it's possible that if you really want the object badly enough, then you're going to kill the person to get it. Do something bad to him to get it. There's a case in Sefer Melachim where the king Achav wanted a certain vineyard that belonged to Navos. And in the end of the story, he basically ended up killing Navos in order to get the vineyard. So you see basically that really bad things could come out of coveting your neighbor's property. Dinei mitzvah, the lochos of the mitzvah, eich roi lisrachik harbe min hamida hara hazos, that it's desirable to get as far away as possible from this terrible character trait. Nidvar b'makomos b'talmo b'pizor u'b'midrashos. It's mentioned, there's not a tractate in the Talmud that discusses the laws of coveting. Rather, it's just mentioned all over the Talmud, the poor character trait that's involved in coveting things. And it's sort of many midrashim and many commentaries on the Torah. It tells many stories about bad things that could happen when you covet. Menuheges b'chol makom v'chol zman b'zchar m'v'nikevos. And it's in all places and all times, men and women. The overall of the chamad, if you coveted, afilo aso boshum maisa, even if you did an action, normally you could think that it could be coveting could be a lav shein b'maisa. No action involves, therefore you wouldn't receive the penalty of malchus. But until you actually go and take the object based on your coveting. Lefishu davar shenitan lehishavon. The reason that you're never, even if you'd actually take the thing, according to the chinuch chayav malchus, I'm sorry. Yeah, that you you could always give the object back. So since you could undo in some ways your transgression, so you never chayav malchus for this reason. So according to the Rambam, this is always considered a lav shein bo maisa, and that's why you don't receive malchus. So you're definitely don't receive the penalty of malchus for coveting. But the question is, it's a difference of agreement between the commentators exactly why. Even if you twist it out of his arms, then you could always give it back. So still, you violated a commandment, and God's going to be mad at you. And you'll find that this object, you're not going to have peace with it. That someone's going to take it from you, or it's going to give you problems, and it's nothing good is going to come out of you taking this object. Like we say, harbe shluchim lamakom, that if there are many ways that God could impose his will on the world, it doesn't have to be through lightning coming and striking you down. It could be in more subtle ways or more subtle things that people could do to you. It could be God taking his revenge on you, so to speak, for coveting this object.